This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
So welcome to episode 4 of Mixtape Memories.
We're really moving along here. Yeah, it's exciting.
I'm Jenners.
I'm Matt Hart Spade.
And we'll be talking about a bunch of nostalgia this week.
Yes.
Got so much for you.
Yes. You noticed earlier this week that Broken Social Scene are doing a big tour.
Yes.
Yes.
Or at least they're coming back to Webster Hall.
Yeah.
And Webster Hall is returning again.
Yes, everything's back.
Everything is returning. So just thinking about Broken Social Scene made me think of that era in music where every band had like 10, 11 members in it.
It was really a thing.
And it was like, why? What is everyone doing in the band? You'd have one guy on tambourine.
Yeah. Well, there were always some people that were totally unnecessary.
Yes.
You know. Yeah. But I remember it was so nonchalantly expressed, like the 17-piece collective from wherever. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's not... That's a little odd.
Yeah, that's like a club or something.
Yeah.
Like a band. But I wonder if they're still a big band, like a big member band, or if they've slimmed down over the years.
Oh, Broken Social Scene?
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't thought about them in a bit. But I mean, obviously, some of the earlier albums I was, a big fan of. And I think they headlined Siren Festival many, 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 many years ago.
Yeah, I think so.
And that was a good set.
Yeah.
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 And they had lots of good offshoots, too, from that band.
What, like Feist?
Well, Feist broke out in a big way.
Yeah, and I mean, the other big one that I remember was Arcade Fire.
Yes.
I don't know. For some reason, I think a lot of Canadian bands were like...
I wonder what that was about.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. But yeah, and I remember like people being like... The first time I saw Arcade Fire, like I didn't know what to think. Because mm-hmm. It was like... I think it was at Mercury Lounge. It was before they kind of broke. And everybody, like tons of people were at the show. They were getting a lot of buzz. And then I just remember being like, holy shit, there's so many people in that band.
Particularly
I didn't know where to look.
Stage.
You know, it's like someone banging like the ceiling. Yeah. And, like another person jumping over here and like, you know. Shaking a tambourine or a rattle or something. Who knows?
Exactly. How was that early show? Because I feel like I've seen photos from that Mercury Lounge gig, but I was not there. I didn't see them till I think they played Webster, maybe a couple months after that.
Yeah. I mean, it was insane. It was just, and I think nobody knew what they were in for. Mm-hmm. So when they saw like all these people just kind of going crazy on this tiny stage. I think people were excited and like and that the buzz built up from that mm-hmm. performance, mm-hmm. I think, because like the next time they were around, they were on tour with Hidden Cameras mm-hmm. and Hidden Cameras was the headliner. Mm. On that tour. But by the time it got to New York, they flipped the order,
right.
And Arcade Fire was the headliner mm-hmm. and Hidden Cameras was the main support. Mm-hmm. And I only remember that because the band I worked with, Dirty on Purpose, was like the opener. I was at first excited that they were gonna be right before Arcade Fire, but then once the lineup switched, I was like, okay. Well, although I love Hidden Cameras, I mean, there's nothing wrong with them, but it was just like one of those tours where the main support got way more popular than the original headliner.
I remember back in the day there was a show at Bowery, and I assume this was a full tour. I think it was. Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. Speaking of throwback bands. They were touring with The National, and The National was touring behind Alligator, which is probably the last National album I really was into many, many, many moons ago. But I recall Clap Your Hands was on before The National at Bowery, and so many people left and really threw me. Yeah. And it's so funny now because The National is this gigantic band, which I don't fully understand, but I mean, good for them.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was one of those bills where it seems like the opener grabbed all this attention and then people were like done.
Yeah. That just shows you how like the trend, like, you know, a trendy band can kind of all of a sudden overtake another band out of the blue. And I can't imagine how awkward that is when you're on tour with a band and like everyone leaves because your opener just got bigger than you.
Like, it's so weird.
You know, that was also a time of weird band names, and I always thought like...
Oh, yeah, we didn't even bring that up in previous episodes, but every band had Wolf or... Remember they were like the Buzz Terms?
Yes.
Bear, Wolf. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, so many things. It was always just like...
It was weirdly repetitive, though. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't understand how there were so many bands with Bear. I mean, there was Grizzly Bear, who obviously took off in a major way. Bear in Heaven.
I don't even know.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of them kind of escaped my brain out, capacity probably. And fizzled out. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember like thinking Vampire Weekend was like a really weird name for a band.
Yeah.
I also thought Dr. Dog was a really weird name for a band. But these bands like took off.
Yeah.
Like, so you never know.
But going back to Arcade Fire and Broken Social Scene, I feel like there were quite a few bands back in the day that had so many members. Some of them still exist, but a lot of them kind of fizzled or ended. Mm-hmm. One that we, I think, are both surprised is still happening is the Polyphonic Spree.
Yeah. I didn't know they were still together. I mean, you would just think that that would be like a hard band to keep together. Mm-hmm. But they probably don't have any original members other than the one guy.
Yeah, probably just Tim, who was in Tripping Daisy.
Oh, my God.
Speaking of memories. Yeah.
And didn't he have something to do with like Waterloo Records?
Yes, he did.
Like
he did.
Founded it or...
He was involved in some sense.
He was involved in some sense, yeah.
I remember seeing Polyphonic Spree though back in the day when the first album was out. And I was moved by some of the earlier shows, but I very quickly was like, this is so gimmicky. And I don't know, it became almost culty.
I remember seeing them... It might have been Summer Stage. It was in Central Park and freaking John Cameron Mitchell came out.
Oh.
And they freaking sang Wig in a Box. And
really?
I lost my shit. And I think that was my coolest. Like, I never thought they were cool, actually. Mm-hmm. But when John Cameron Mitchell came out and sang with them, I was like, maybe they're cool.
Maybe they're
just cool. Just for that one thing. But then, like, I think I maybe saw them at Warsaw the last time, maybe?
Yeah, I think I saw them once at Warsaw, and then I want to say the Virgin Megastore that used to exist in the East Village.
Oh, wow.
Or was it a tower? Forget, on East 4th on the corner.
Oh, that was Tower.
It was Tower, excuse me. I saw them do an album signing there and a performance. The album signing took forever because 24 members had a signed
CD. I can't imagine them performing at a Tower Records.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and who, like, did they all sign?
They all signed the album. And it was a CD. It was like
ridiculous.
Pre-vinyl craze.
That must have taken forever. They had to be pre-signed, those
Yeah,
things.
They should have done that. I kind of want to dig that up in my archive, see if I still have it somewhere.
You should, yeah. We could do that some episode.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. what you were mentioning, John Cameron Mitchell coming out for the Polyphonic Spree, I remember seeing Arcade Fire at Summer Stage. I think it was either the Funeral Tour or maybe Neon Bible, I don't remember, way back. And Bowie came out and sang, oh goodness, I forget which Bowie song it was. Anyway, he sang with them, and I was like, okay, this is a moment now where I understand that they've reached a certain level of success, but they're really going to be gigantic.
Well, like that show where they were playing with hidden cameras at Bowery, all I remember from that show is how everyone was like, David Bowie is here. David Byrne is here. Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. Both Davids were there. Both David B's were there.
Yes, yes.
And sometimes that's how you knew a band was cool. If David Byrne or David Bowie that's were at true. Their show, then you'd be like, huh. That's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, it must have come full circle for them to actually perform with him.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
There were some other bands, though, that had a lot of members. And I remember this one called I'm From Barcelona.
Oh, my gosh.
And I know that they played one of those pool parties at McCarran Park that were so big, those jelly NYC parties in the mid-2000s.
I love those parties, those were
really
way.
Fun. And they, I don't even think they headlined. I want to feel like they were one of the openers. But that band had at least, I don't even know, 17, 20 members. And I do recall while they were in town, because they weren't from New York, they were from somewhere in Western Europe. I don't remember exactly off the top of my head. But they played Southpaw, which is a venue that no longer exists in Brooklyn and Park Slope.
Southpaw.
They couldn't all fit on the stage. So they were they were interspersed in the crowd.
I mean, and I don't feel like that wasn't a very tiny stage either. So
no.
Like, you could just imagine.
Yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot. But they were fun. And I recall they had a song called We're From Barcelona, even though they were not from Barcelona. So that was kind of weird.
Typical indie irony. There,
yeah, I guess. Know. That was the pinnacle of all of that.
Oh my gosh.
And then New Pornographers are still a thing, although I think Nico Case is officially like out of the band now.
Oh,
I think.
Okay.
But they have a ton of members and they still tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're still kicking. Some of these acts are still going. Yeah. At it, you know.
I mean, you have to be a pretty big band to like in popularity to kind of sustain that kind of financial
exactly.
strain on you to have like a bunch of members. Because that's not easy to tour with.
No.
And then, of course, there's Chick Chick Chick.
Yeah, and they're still going.
Our favorite.
Yeah. I mean, they
exclamation
were.
Exclamation point band.
Yes. Which so many people had challenging time yes. saying out loud, trying to figure out what to say, you know?
I know. Like, I wonder if people still, like people who are, like, maybe just coming across them mm-hmm. now, like, I wonder if they're confused.
Yeah, I think so. But, I mean, at this point, they've been around for so long, like, 2 decades. If people don't know who they are
yeah.
by now, it's not going to happen.
It took me a really long time to get into Chick Chick Chick. Mm-hmm. Like, for a while, I hated them. Mm-hmm. And, like, I, you know, as a blogger who is always in the front taking photos and, like, you know, supporting bands and stuff, like they were one of those bands that like did not want photography. In fact, they like would heckle the photographers and like throw water
uh-huh.
at them. And, you know, at the time I like, you know, hated that about them, but now it's like looking back, I kind of understand.
Totally.
Like, now everyone's taking photos at the show mm-hmm. and it is kind of annoying when, when no one's like, you want people in the front to be like living in the moment
mm-hmm.
so you could feed off that energy. So mm-hmm. I kind of understand it now, but at the time I was really bratty and like was like, why don't they want me to take their photo?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, but you know, I think the turning moment for me was when they did, I feel like it was a New Year's Eve show.
Yeah, it was at
Mercury Lounge.
I went to that.
Yeah. And I was hanging out with Sharice Brecker
uh-huh.
and she I don't know, that night we like that was the turning point for me mm-hmm. like that show and whatever they did, it just clicked for mm-hmm. me, and then all of a sudden I was like having fun.
Yeah.
Maybe I put down the camera, I don't know.
It could be a lesson for people nowadays too.
Yeah. And yeah. And ever since then, I just thought that they were really fun to watch and to dance to. And, you know, Nick is like just so funny in his little shorts.
Oh, my goodness. And his moves.
And his moves, his dance moves.
Yeah. If you can call them moves. But you know what? He's super entertaining.
So entertaining.
Yeah. I haven't seen them in a few years, but But I mean, they always put on a fun show.
Always.
You know, it's just how it is.
And they always had like a bunch of band members and, you know, a little rotating cast there. But overall, like, you know, a fun band.
And they were part of that indie dance movement, if you will, yeah. In New York at that time, because not everyone fell into that boat, but they really did. And they kind of combined, I want to say even disco influences with punk, with typical New York 70s kind of downtown CBGB kind of culture. It was kind of a nice mix of everything, plus something modern.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's hard to get New Yorkers to dance, and they did. They got people dancing. Mm-hmm. So, like, kudos to them for getting people dancing.
Yes, kudos to Chick, Chick, Chick.
For dancing and still dancing.
Yes, yes. You know, another band that we have fond memories of from that time that got people dancing is The Fever.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh, The Fever.
Which who I haven't thought of in some time. But I remember seeing them a few times at Bowery and then, of course, smaller venues as well. And I got to say, quickly revisiting their bigger singles, those were some jams.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, my God. I like just how, like, raw and, like, rock and roll they were, and it was a different kind of dance, right? It's like that kind of you know, that Velvet Underground song, Rock and Roll. It's like she started dancing to that 5/5 music. That's kind of like what I think of when I think of The Fever. It's just like good old rock and roll, and you're dancing to it. But I remember being at like a Fever show and being up front and getting hit in the face with a microphone stand.
Oh, no.
But that was fun to me. I mean, nowadays, I'd probably be like, what the hell?
It made for a good story to write about.
Yes,
maybe.
Yeah. It made for a good story. But yeah, that's the kind of haphazards that would happen if you were in the front.
Exactly,
at a show.
Exactly.
But they were like kind of in like a cool kids club in a lot of ways. Someone just told me that maybe Blue Sparks, who were always playing with The Fever back then, might reunite too.
Okay.
Maybe Mercury Lounge is like putting together all these like 25-year reunion shows. In fact, Doug from Dirty on Purpose told me that they were approached to play, but like he was like, George and Joe haven't picked up a guitar since like that they reunited once for a when Death by Audio was closing. And they played that show, but then they haven't picked up instruments since then.
Oh.
So, but it's interesting to see, like, all these bands kind of coming back together.
Yeah.
So I wonder if The Fever will happen. That would be cool.
I mean, and I feel like if it were to happen, even if it only happens in New York for one night, that's kind of enough, because that's where all the fans are or were. You know.
Yeah. And they're probably still here if they haven't like moved to LA or something.
Exactly. But that was a good band from back then. Also, for some reason, when I think of The Fever, I think of The Bravery. Do you remember them?
Oh, my gosh.
Because they were kind of dancey and buzzy, but also a total joke, I feel.
Yeah.
Kind of became the butt of the joke, because I feel like their look was so forced and it was trying so hard to be like combination emo meets new wave meets like hipster supreme. It was, I don't know, but they had a couple songs that I guess were fine, but they were really trying their hardest to like break through to the mainstream, you know.
Oddly, I think they were like a band that got more popular than any of these like kind of more substantial bands, which I don't know, just goes to show you sometimes it's like very superficial. Whenever I think of The Bravery, I think I was at Mercury Lounge. All goes back to Mercury Lounge, folks. That was like pretty much where I lived back in the day. But yeah, I might have worked with a band that maybe played with them. Or maybe, I don't know. For some reason, I was like near a dressing room, and I just remember them exiting the bathroom of the dressing room and just like a haze of hairspray smoke.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Coming out of the bathroom, and you're just like... That pretty much sums up The Bravery for me.
Exactly. Exactly.
A lot of hairspray.
A lot of hairspray. Everything was shiny.
Everything was shiny. But What about the Stills?
Now, the Stills I used to dance to, but I feel like their music was a lot more serious.
Yes.
And I feel like they didn't necessarily sound similar, but perhaps they were put in the same boat as someone like Interpol. Mm. Just because it was
like dark.
Dark, and... yeah. Good-looking front men, whatever. But,
right.
They were great. And I really loved their initial EP, which had like so many remixes of Still in Love. For some reason, I remember that. Mm. And then when the full album came out, I thought it was really, really strong.
Yeah, no, I think Logic Will Break Your Heart.
Of course. Yes, yeah. Of course.
But yeah, and I know you don't remember them, but I also think of Moving Units when I think of this. And they were more LA dance band kind of scene. So a little bit more about like maybe what they were wearing, but like still good songs. And I don't know. I want to say they're still kicking. They're
still kicking? Okay.
But maybe they died in the past few years.
As a band.
As a band. No, they haven't reached the that kind of end.
Yes, yes.
Back then also like labels were still a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you're listening to like Kamado Records, like, you know, The Fever, Elephant, like Diamond Nights, they all had like a very particular sound.
Yeah. Yeah.
What other labels were around back then?
Well, I mean, I always think of running around from show to show with Leo Canine, who's still kicking, you know?
Canine is like such a good one because he has such a good track record of picking
bands. He put out the first Grizzly Bear album before it was re-released.
Yeah.
The first Chairlift album.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness, what else? I just feel like he really had his finger on the pulse. Surfer Blood before they were huge.
I think he still does.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's really good at picking bands. And actually, like, at the panel that he moderated that panel at New Colossus that was talking about the relevancy of indie labels. And he told the story about how he signed Grizzly Bear. And it was like some person that he was friends with just gave him this email address and was like, you have to email this person. Mm-hmm. And like, they were the only band I think that he signed without ever seeing them.
Mm.
And he said something like, that Ed had told him, like, I'm going to be famous. So you just need to sign me.
You need to make it happen.
Yeah. You just need to sign me. And I'm guaranteeing you, I'm going to be famous. And now he's on,
well,
you know,
now, yeah.
Now he is famous.
Well, yeah, and has, and not only that, but like super well respected indie band for the last decade or 15 years even.
Yeah.
You know, so he was right, I guess.
Yeah.
Cocky maybe, but he was right.
And I mean, sometimes you need, like, I think to be like a big star, you have to have a little bit of cockiness or like at least confidence, you know, and really you have to believe that you'll make it. Otherwise, you'll only maybe push yourself so far. I don't know. What do you think about that? Do you have to be crazy to be successful?
I don't know if it's necessary, but maybe somewhat, partially. Mm-hmm. I also feel particularly with Grizzly Bear, their sound evolved so much that what they were putting out initially versus what they put out by album two or three was a lot more accessible and huge sounding, and people were more drawn to it because the earlier stuff is a lot more sparse.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I think they were smart about building the sound.
Yeah.
You know? And not just sticking to the same thing over and over.
Right.
But then again, I mean, and no disrespect to The National, but that's a band for me that's put out the same song and the same album now for a long time, and they're still huge. So, you know, that also works for some acts.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't even tell you a National song, to be honest, but never quite got into them. I think it was because like I always compared them to the Walkman. The Walkman would always win for me.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I was going to choose like a serious kind of whatever tall white guy band to follow, you know, like it was them.
It was the Walkman, yeah.
And maybe I was comparing them because at some point they had the same manager. I was comparing them, but like, yeah, they got huge. And
oh God,
I just don't understand. There's so many bands I don't understand, like, why they got huge.
I think with the National in particular, their fan base now is super bro-y and like.
That's so weird.
Yeah, like khaki wearing, like frat boy types.
You know, it's kind of over. At least it is for me. Maybe it's not for the general public, but it's kind of over when I start seeing frat boys at a show. Like, I remember going to see Modest Mouse, you know, right after Float On was like the big hit or whatever.
Of course, yeah, it was a big radio single.
Yeah, and it was, this was at Webster Hall, actually. And I was at the show and, oh my God, I got cornered at Webster Hall by these frat dudes who were like harassing me. Oh my and God. They literally cornered me and I couldn't like escape. And then, but luckily, like one of my friends came over and like kind of like rescued me. But it was like, I was like, oh my God, I'm at this Modest Mouse show being fucking cornered by frat boys. Like, never thought that would happen to me. I never thought I would be at a show where that would happen. And it was scary. And I was like, this is who's listening to Modest Mouse? Like, fuck that shit. Like, I mean, I love Modest Mouse, but like, it's weird how it just changes once it becomes a little mainstream, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'll always like the older tracks.
Of course, yeah.
You know? So we'll do our repeat and skip segment.
Yes. Two classic albums, although one I feel is more legendary and perhaps yes. than the other. Let's start with that one, maybe.
Okay. So, yeah, Nirvana, Nevermind.
I mean, we couldn't skip this one.
Yeah.
Speaking of, obviously such a monumental album.
Yeah.
You know, life-changing album for a lot of people. I have to admit, I was a little young when this came out, so I don't have the same connection to it that perhaps some other people do, but I do have fond memories, of course, and particularly some of the singles.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why I chose In Bloom. I feel like that is just such a like legendary track. Perfect chorus. You know, when I think Nirvana, I think of that song first, probably. And then, of course, Smells Like Teen Spirit. But yeah, I love that song so much. Also, I love Heart Shape. I mean, there's so many great Nirvana songs, but ones that are on this album, probably In Bloom, I think, is my number one.
Yeah, I mean, this was the first CD I ever bought. I mean, it was like that and Boyz II Men, Coolie High Harmony. I actually bought them at the same time.
Oh, amazing.
So, but like, you know, I just remember being in high school and thinking, what is this? I want this, whatever this is. And like really kind of, I mean, do you remember that video for Smells Like Teen Spirit?
Of course. Yeah.
I mean, like, I remember doing like a project on like, we had to put like a presentation together about like, what career do you want to be? And I, for some reason, thought I wanted to be a director, and I like played the video for Smells Like Teen Spirit and then like the Weird Al version and put them side by side. And I was like, this is why I want to be a director.
What was the reaction?
I don't know. People were just like, yeah, okay. Whatever. I mean, it was like a presentation. No one cared. But yeah, like, it was just so ingrained in my memory. I mean, Kurt Cobain was like a huge influence. I mean, I was definitely like a grunge kid in high school. And, you know, I would say like over the years, Lounge Act, that's my repeat. I mean, like, there's just something about that track, like how it kind of starts with like this, like, you know, guttural vocal, like uttering, and then kind of comes into like the track. There's something about it that just spoke to me. And so like, if I, when I used to DJ and stuff, I would play Lounge Act actually. But of course, like, there's so many hits on this album.
Yeah. It's like, very hit heavy.
And like, that was like the craziness of Nirvana. Like, it wasn't like they just had one song and a big song and then like a few other tracks. Like, they had so many hits off this album and all their other albums. Did you have a, what was your skip?
My skip was Territorial Pissings. I think that was always a little too much for me. So yeah, that one is a skip. I also, even though I didn't pick this one as a repeat, I do love Something in the Way. I think that's such a beautiful track. And yeah. I always love it on an album where there is one or two songs that really stand out as breaking from the mold of the rest of the release. Mm. And I think that one is a good one. And
Yeah, it kind of shows you like a different side mm-hmm. to the band, for sure.
That's why for me, when I think Nirvana and my connection personally with the band, I'm more drawn to The Unplugged, which came out a few years later. I had that on cassette. That mm-hmm. was what I was more drawn to because I was just kind of young when Nevermind came out. But yeah.
I mean, there were so many Unplugs back then.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everyone had Unplugged. So influential. Well,
it was also
series.
Like it wasn't just one type of act because you'd have Mariah Carey singing Emotions and you know, everything else, all the early 90s hits. And then the following week would be Pearl Jam. So it was mm-hmm. all over the board.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. I think even Meat Puppets might have had. Uh-huh. Or no, maybe no. Nirvana just played a Meat Puppet
Nirvana's,
song.
Yeah,
that's
of
what
course.
It was.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Territory Pussy's like, I like that it's a little bit of harder edge songs. That's kind of what I love about Nirvana is that they can get really, really crazy and then really surprise you mm-hmm, when they're mm-hmm. like slow and like really pretty and like melodic. Mm-hmm. And but like for some reason when I was revisiting this album, like I didn't remember like the quote unquote secret track that was on it, Endless Nameless.
I remember the name of the song, but I don't know why. Either like when I had it on cassette, I might have just stopped it after Something in the Way, or you know, we were doing some research and apparently like the first version of the album didn't have the secret track. Although I doubt that was the version I had.
Yeah. Like now I want to go back and like look at the CD I have and see if it was on there. Apparently it was only on the first 20,000 or so.
Yeah.
Pressings.
Something like that.
They left it off by mistake. And then, but I don't remember. I mean, it must have been on the road. There's no way that I was like one of the first 20,000.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine.
No,
that.
I can't imagine myself either.
You know, and yeah, I'm pretty sure I bought it at a mall. Mm-hmm. And by that time, they were giant.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't think we were within the first 20,000.
Yeah.
Within the first 20 million, maybe, not 20,000.
But anyway, I picked that as my skip. Because obviously, I don't remember it. Endless and Nameless. It shall be. Oh, yeah. We picked another a funner album to kind of do. Just kind of silly.
Yeah. It came out a couple years after Nevermind. And I don't even know where to begin with this album. It's actually one of the first albums I ever owned on cassette. I think it was my second purchase.
Oh, wow.
I want to say it came out in 94. It's Green Day's Dookie.
Yes.
I have lots of memories of this album, but one memory I do have is I woke up early on a Saturday morning once and tried to draw that album cover, which is so elaborate, and I never finished it. So 25
years
later.
What made you
like want
to draw it? That's so right.
I don't know. I was feeling super creative. Oh, okay. But yeah, I never finished
I'm
it. So.
That Green Day inspired you.
I just thought back in the day when I was like 13, 14, that Billy Joe Armstrong was the coolest. I don't know why. It's kind of embarrassing now, but I thought he was so cool with his manic panic hair, and he would wear like a sweater, and he was kind of punk, but at the same time, obviously it was mainstream alternative type stuff. I don't know. I was really drawn to him, and I remember the Woodstock performance where he's throwing the mud at people. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I thought
he was
badass.
Back then they were
at 13.
Cool. You know? And before they were like on MTV hit, they were legit. Like,
yeah, exactly.
As a punk band, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, going mainstream kind of made them cheesy, even though it was kind of cool that they were like cool for a second.
Yeah.
I mean,
I do recall buying the album after this, but then I really gave up. And then of course they had that huge single, Time of Your Life, Good Riddance, which became like a graduation song. So weird.
That is so weird.
And probably soundtrack to a lot of film scores and stuff. I don't know. But anyway, going back to Dookie, I think, I'm going to be super basic, but my favorite song on this album is the one that I first fell in love with, which is like maybe the third single from the release, When I Come Around. Mm-hmm. I just remember that video, watching it on MTV and seeing Billy Joe and the rest of the band kind of walking the streets. And I don't know. I thought they were so freaking cool. And it's embarrassing now, but I was 13. So yeah. Deal with it. yeah. So that was my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, I had a hard time kind of picking a repeat from this album.
It's not one that I really ever go back to or have any desire to, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually kind of hard going back and listening to some tracks. And, like, listening, like, I definitely didn't listen to, like, whole songs when I was reviewing this episode. But, like... You know, of course, I remember Longview. That was probably like the song I listened to the most out of everything. I remember Basket Case. But, you know, it didn't really like stand the test of time for me. Like, I can't go back and like really listen to it with genuine like.
Yeah, exactly.
For, you know.
So in that said, what was your least favorite? What was your skip? Or is it the whole album?
Yeah, I'm going to skip the whole album. But if I had to pick one, yeah, I think I would pick the FOD song. And also that weird song.
Their secret track.
Yeah. All by myself.
Yeah.
That was weird. I looked up what FOD stood
for. Oh, what
for,
does it stand
like,
for?
Because I couldn't remember if it's.
I couldn't remember either.
Any guesses?
I have no clue. Give me what does the F stand for?
Fuck.
Fuck or die? I don't know.
Close. Fuck off and die.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I was like, I didn't know that was the abbreviation for fuck off and die.
It's kind of, in a way, a little ironic because that song is the most timid on the release and has the most aggressive title.
Well, I guess that's why they made it an acronym.
Yeah, I guess so.
They didn't actually go full force.
That was also, by the way, my least favorite. That's my skip. Mm. It so stands out as like, what is this?
Yeah.
I mean, like you said, this isn't an album I really ever go back to, but I definitely don't want to hear like the cheesy, tacky last song acoustic. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like weird to how a band like was cool when you're younger and you had like this different perception of it. Mm-hmm. And then as you get older, or maybe as their success grows, because sometimes success kind of cheapens the art of an artist in a way. Like, they maybe lose touch with reality and they don't know what's cool anymore. Or they have different pressures. They have, like, the major label pressures or whatever. But Green Day, I mean, they became, like, more of a joke, I think.
But I mean, wildly successful. They had the Broadway show for American Idiot.
I think that's so insane to me
that
they had a Broadway show. Like, any other band like that have a Broadway show?
Wasn't the Who? No?
Well, like, the Who were cool.
Yeah, the Who were cool.
Like, on another level.
Not that many. I mean, it's a small pool.
But, like, you wouldn't imagine that
you
out of
Green
all
Day.
The bands that could possibly have a show, it would be Green Day.
You would have thought it'd be Stone Temple Pilots.
Oh,
I know.
Stone Temple Pilots. Holy crap.
But I do. I remember, actually, I had a T-shirt that had the album art of Dookie on it. And in the back, it had some sort of lyric. And my mom got it from me at an indoor flea market in Brooklyn. I remember just being super into this album. And I even remember that the cassette was like this shade of like dark blue. I don't know. The things you remember, it's strange. But especially since it's like 25 years ago. But I cannot listen to this album now. I have no desire to. But at the time, it was a very important album for me.
Yeah.
It was one that I listened to like in my headphones, you know, in my Walkman all the time.
I mean, I thought it was, like, pretty, I don't know if revolutionary is the word, but I thought it was pretty punk that they had a song about masturbation that was on the radio.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in a lot of ways, they were good in that they were trying to be counterculture,
mm-hmm.
but it ended up being very, you know, mainstream in a lot of ways.
I feel like in a sense, even though I never really think about it, this might have been the beginning of the whole like mall punk kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where afterwards you had bands like Blink 182 and everyone else that followed suit.
The whole like weird pop punk explosion happened. Very California-y kind of bands. You're right. Like a lot of them.
A lot of them.
I mean, so many bands that like maybe even were influenced by those bands that came out then and then like are just awful nowadays.
Yeah. There's a lot of music in general, I think, from the mid and late 90s that was played heavily on alternative radio that is, looking back, just terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, Smash Mouth, Third Eye Blind.
Yeah.
Matchbox 20.
Oh my gosh.
So many. Seven Mary 3. So many bands with numbers. There's a lot. Train. There was so much terrible stuff.
I mean, whoever
Everclear.
Whoever Eve influenced Six. Limp Bizkit, they should not be. That should not have been a thing.
No.
But it was. There was like the whole like weird rap. Thing that was going like on
right around the millennium.
I mean, I was super not into that at I don't know, other bands that I bet other people would clock me for like mentioning, like Good Charlotte. Not into the Madden Brothers.
Kind of going full circle, I feel like one of those guys tried to make a name for himself in the New York early 2000s scene as what, like a photographer or something?
Photographer?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know.
Well, these days anyone can be a photographer.
Well, that's true. That's true.
It's like...
if you have the right Instagram filters and, you know, apps on your phone.
Right, exactly. It's all about the filter.
Yeah.
But like...
Oh, Filter's another band from that time period. That's pretty atrocious.
Dude, though, I had Filter on vinyl, first off, okay?
The album with Hey Man, Nice Shot?
Yeah. And on top of that, like, it was probably the only album I had on vinyl when I was in high school. And I was a very, like, I was a very emo kid, like, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I was very, like, you know, introverted, like, sad, whatever kid. And so, like... Anytime my parents never let me do anything. And so anytime I was like mad at my dad or something, I would put on
Filter.
I was just like turn the volume up really loud.
Oh my God.
And that would be like my rebellion. And I think back on it now, it's so embarrassing to think about, but like there's something about I mean, was it called Hey Man, Nice Shot?
That was the big single.
Yeah.
And Take a Picture was like a more mellow track. That was a single.
No, I would put on Hey Man, Nice Shot and just like put on full blast. That was me being like rebellious.
I think my rebellion album was, and this is also incredibly embarrassing, and we've touched upon this act in a previous episode, but Marilyn Manson, Antichrist Superstar.
Oh, wow.
When I was 15, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that was probably like a lot of people's rebellion album.
Yeah.
So iconically rebellious.
Yeah, particularly at that time, I feel, when he was really breaking.
There was like nothing like Marilyn Manson at the time that got so that big, you know? I mean, he was doing like the weird, like, blurry gender lines and like the makeup and then just how quiet he was in like real life, you know?
And incredibly intelligent.
Yeah.
You know?
Smart.
That was an interesting time. But you know what? If I heard The Beautiful People out, I think that's still a good song to dance to. Not gonna lie. You know what? Actually, I heard out this has been a couple years now, but I feel like it's along the same vein in terms of like that kind of darker, maybe metal inspired, whatever, alternative sound. Was White Zombie More Human Than Human?
Oh.
And that actually is fun to dance to. I heard that very randomly and I was kind of feeling it. So that's it for episode 4 of Mixtape Memories. Thanks for tuning in. We will be back shortly with episode 5. And thanks again. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.